Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. We start in Lebanon, where the army says three of its soldiers have been killed in southern Lebanon in a single Israeli airstrike. Lebanon's US-funded army has tried to stay out of the conflict between Israel and the militant group Hezbollah. Israel's defense minister Yoav Gallant told his troops that Israel was destroying Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and that the attacks would continue. They are continuing at the moment. The BBC's Jonathan Head is in Beirut, and I asked him shortly before we came on air about those Lebanese army deaths first.
We haven't been told much in terms of detail. There's simply been a statement from the army saying that these three soldiers were in a vehicle going between two small villages very close to the border with Israel when they were hit by an Israeli airstrike and killed them. I assume their vehicle was completely destroyed, and we've seen quite a number of vehicles targeted by the Israelis in this campaign when they're after an individual. We don't know why they would go after a Lebanese military vehicle, but it is an area of intense fighting at the moment, both in the air, lots of aerial bombardments, but also it's an area where Israeli ground forces are close by fighting quite difficult battles with Hezbollah. So anyone down there, that includes the Lebanese army and the UN forces there, even though they're not actually taking part in this fighting, they are at risk of getting caught up in this. And there's been no comment so far from the Israeli side about why it happened.
Meanwhile, the Israeli airstrikes continue and the government in Jerusalem says it's widening its targets, its targeting of Hezbollah.
Yes, it's hard to imagine this incredible bombing campaign widening, but we're now being told that tonight the Israeli Defense Force will go after what it describes as Hezbollah's financial structures. And that, we assume, is basically describing the Al-Qaeda Al-Hassan Association. I mean, this is like a bank. It has branches in large parts of Beirut, and quite large numbers of branches. So if they're going to target those banks, we don't know. They haven't specified, but they've told residents of Beirut to be prepared for the often quite short-notice warnings that they give to get out. So we're expecting probably quite a lot of bombing later tonight.
The Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, says his country is defeating Hezbollah and destroying them in all the villages along the border. And yet the war aim is far from having been achieved, isn't it? Hezbollah rockets are still being fired over the border.
Defeat's an interesting concept. I'm not quite sure how the Israeli military is measuring success. There's a lot we don't know. We don't have any real sense about how badly damaged Hezbollah is. We know they've lost a lot of top leaders. We know it must have become a much more difficult for them to operate. But it's extremely unlikely that Israel is close to reaching that stage where it can be sure there will no longer be attacks into northern Israel.
What are Lebanese civilians telling you about how they're coping?
Oh, this country is so weary of war. I mean, it's had so much of it in its modern history. It's just a real ground-down sort of pessimism. And, I mean, Lebanese, of course, have always found ways to cope. Humour, distractions, you know, it's amazing how people carry on. But this country is a punching bag at the moment. It's being hammered and pummeled because of Israel's war with Hezbollah. Many Lebanese are furious with Hezbollah for dragging them into this. But, of course, there is real anger towards Israel. It's just the indiscriminate nature of the attacks. It doesn't matter how precise they are. And we know Israel's capable, the Israeli Defense Forces are capable of being very, very precise. But these bombs are so appallingly destructive. I mean, I was looking at one neighborhood this morning that had been hit by an Israeli bomb, maybe two yesterday. and it looked like an earthquake had hit it. There were just multiple buildings. These are multi-story buildings, literally leaning over on their sides, and the whole backs of them had been completely blown out. And then there were great gaping holes where there'd been buildings. There was nothing left at all. Never mind the civilians who were killed and injured in the bomb strike, but you've now got a whole bunch more families who've lost their home. Every day, hundreds of families are being dehoused by these brutal bomb attacks that are often aiming sometimes at only one person. You know, with that kind of campaign, the apparent heartlessness of the Israeli campaign, which is what Lebanese feel. They feel that the Israelis have no concern whatsoever for Lebanese lives, makes them very angry. So they've got lots of people to be angry with and very little power. The Lebanese government has always been weak. It's literally helpless as it watches its country being torn apart by the war between these two entities, between Israel and Hezbollah.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Beirut. The United Nations peacekeeping force, still stationed in Lebanon, says an Israeli army bulldozer today deliberately demolished one of its observation towers on the perimeter fence of a UNIFIL position in southern Lebanon. Several UNIFIL troops have already been injured, carrying out their duties in the area close to the Israeli border. Whether or not those injuries were the result of direct Israeli gunfire has not been firmly established. Andrea Tenenti is UNIFIL's spokesman in Beirut.
Today, the UN position that is very close to the blue line and is manned by Ghanaian peacekeepers, an IDF bulldozer demolished an observation tower and also the perimeter around the UN position. From what we have seen, also the videos, was clearly a deliberate attack against our base. This is again another of the attacks that we have been suffering in the last several weeks from the Israeli Defense Forces. That's the sixth of the seven attacks that we suffered for the last couple of weeks, starting with one of the tower inside our headquarters in Nakura that was hit by a Merkava tank. Two peacekeepers were injured. Two other positions also were targeted. The illumination, the cameras. Last week, another Ghanaian position, IDF, entered forcibly inside the base, and they stayed there for 45 minutes. So these are all deliberate attacks that are putting in danger the peacekeepers in south of Lebanon.
And immediately before this latest incident or after it, did you have any contact with Israeli officials?
Not before. We have ongoing communications with the IDF. There is a communication channel open with the head of mission and force commander that he has, of course, talked to them about this event. At times they have to get back to us. So no, they're doing an investigation, but I think it's been clear, not only from UNIFIL, but the international community has been very vocal in recent weeks that peacekeepers should not be targeted. Even US President last week said the same thing. So it's important that this is a violation not only of Resolution 1701, but also a violation of international humanitarian law. So peacekeepers should not be targeted.
They say they're going to investigate. I assume that means they haven't apologized.
I have not heard any apologies so far. We will know tomorrow after. Maybe we'll discuss it with the head of mission and force commander, General Lazaro. But at the moment, that's what we have seen. A bulldozer clearly ramming against our position, against the tower, against the perimeter of the base. So this is another concerning incident, especially after a couple of weeks ago, the IDF asked UNIFIL to move from some of the position close to the blue line. Israeli Prime Minister also addressed directly the Secretary General of the United Nations, asking for the mission to move from the south. The decision was taken by the Security Council, by all the troop contributing countries of UNIFIL to stay. We are staying at the request, of course, of the Lebanese authorities, because the mission was is in south of Lebanon at the request of the Lebanese authorities, but we are also at the request of the Security Council.
Andrea Tenenti there, spokesperson for UNIFIL in Beirut. We asked the Israeli military for an interview. They told us no one was available. The US government is investigating a leak of highly classified intelligence documents describing Israel's preparations for a retaliatory strike on Iran. The documents that circulated on the Telegram app seem to describe Israeli Air Force and Navy planning based on recent satellite imagery. Israel has been planning a response to an Iranian ballistic missile attack at the start of this month. Mick Mulroy is a former CIA officer. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East in the Trump administration. He is now an analyst for ABC News and senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He joins us live. Welcome, Mr. Mulroy. How big a concern is this leak?
Well, it should be a big concern. One, because we have shown, we, the United States, have shown that we have had problems maintaining classified material in classified spaces, and that this is not the first time that this has happened, and it needs to be addressed, and there needs to be steps taken so that doesn't happen again. Not just because of the relationship with Israel, but the relationship with all those that provide information to the U.S. intelligence community to be able to make our assessments and analysis.
Do you know how it's been leaked? Because it's a big deal if it was intentional on the part of U.S. intelligence, perhaps.
That is a good question. I don't think it would be intentional on the part of U.S. intelligence, but it's perhaps an individual who, for whatever reason, political or otherwise, decided to remove this these documents from classified spaces and somehow get it to an account that was linked, we believe, through reporting, media reporting, to Iran. Whether that was the case or whether it was actually hacked, the question about the hacking part is it's very difficult to hack any system that has this level of classified material. So I think we need to wait for the investigation, but I think they're probably focusing on an individual that deliberately took these documents outside of a secured facility.
Do the documents make mention of Israel's nuclear capabilities, something that Israel never refers to in public?
So, of course, there hasn't been confirmation that these are, in fact, legitimate material. So we've seen comments today all the way up to Speaker of the House, the investigation was going on. So obviously there is an issue. This isn't a spoof, I would say. But I don't think you'll see here anybody commenting on the information in the material, whether they're inside the government or now, like myself, outside of the government. But obviously, this is the biggest issue when it comes to leaking classified information, is it's not just our information. It could easily also be our allies' information.
It's obviously a delicate time for the two allies, for U.S.-Israel relations. What implications could this leak have for them?
So I agree. It is a delicate time between the relationships, obviously between President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu. But it's an enduring relationship that doesn't really have to do with who is prime minister or president. So that is important to point out. But this just further, I think, would challenge Israel's idea that they have to share everything with the United States, that the United States should know every step they're going to take. We've seen some criticism against Israel for not doing that. This will just further, I think, support their position that they don't know whether this information will get out because of our inability to keep classified information secure. And I think this is just further going to make that a problem.
Mick Mulroy, former CIA officer, now with the Middle East Institute in Washington. Many thanks. You're with the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. We're live from London. Coming up, the polls have closed in Moldova's pivotal elections. We'll hear from the country's former foreign minister on Moscow's attempts to buy votes in his country.
I'm not aware of any other places where we've seen such a sort of brazen and kind of open attempt to corrupt a particular election.
The news headlines: Israel has signalled a further expansion of its bombing campaign in Lebanon, warning civilians to stay away from offices of a firm it accuses of financing Hezbollah. And a Mexican priest who campaigned for indigenous rights has been shot dead outside a church in the southern state of Chiapas. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Almost the entire population of the Cuban capital, Havana, has been without power today after another partial failure of the country's national grid overnight. It's the third recent outage and a big setback to the government's efforts to restore power to residents who are already exhausted by severe shortages of food, medicine and fuel. The imminent arrival on Cuban shores of Hurricane Oscar threatens to complicate things further now. Cristiana Mesquita is bureau chief for the Associated Press news agency in the Caribbean. I asked her how bad it had been for Cuba with this outage.
It's not just Havana, it was the whole country. And obviously we felt it more in Havana, which is a city of 2 million people. People that have already been suffering for months with electricity shortages, with power shortages. So what started on Thursday evening when they announced they would not be able to provide even half of the power that would be required in the country and ended up being a total collapse on a Friday morning when one of the main energy plants went to bed practically. And that's when, you know, the whole country went dark. Energy is being restored at the moment, little by little. We already saw some places in Havana where the electricity is back. We understand that some other parts of the country are also coming through with electricity. And we just came out of a press conference with the Minister for Energy, Vincent Olevi, who said that he hopes that by tomorrow or Tuesday morning latest, it's going to go back to normal.
A lot of people there are quite fed up with the government, aren't they? What's gone wrong?
Well, I mean, it's the latest on a series of issues that they've been having. As I said, you know, power has been a problem for quite some time now, with them having to rotate areas of the country or neighborhoods that would not have power for a certain number of hours a day. And add to that, that there's also a water shortage, also connected to the energy problems because you don't have electricity to run the pumps. So yes, people are upset, but they are not coming out to protest. I mean, so far we have not reported any organized protests. I mean, we see people in the streets saying, you know, we can't take this anymore. But so far, no big demonstrations or anything like we saw in July 2021. When people did go out en masse and to protest specifically about the energy problem.
Now, with this storm approaching Cuba and the east of the island expected to be particularly badly hit, it could get worse, couldn't it?
It could. It actually, you know, even though they're calling it a tiny storm, it's going to be big enough to affect most of the eastern, southeastern tip of the island. And it is a concern because especially that area is also one of the main hubs for electricity generating for Cuba, which means that if you have a lot of rain, you know, transformers will go down and it might get the situation even worse than it is.
How are hospitals and essential services like them able to run amidst all this?
Hospitals and civil defense are running. They kept it running throughout this whole power outage with some limited services, but they are running. They all have generators and they are keeping those generators going. So, as I said, both hospitals, civil defense centers, they are all running as far as we know.
Cristiana Mesquita of the Associated Press in Cuba. More than 70 fake bomb threats are reported to have been made against Indian Airlines this week. The result has been global travel delays. All the flights landed safely, but planes were diverted to Canada and Germany, and fighter jets were scrambled to escort aircraft in the skies above Britain and Singapore. India's government says very strict action will be taken. I've been speaking to our South Asia editor, Anbarasan Ettirajan.
For the past 1 week, dozens of flights received these fake threats from anonymous sources, mostly posted on social media, particularly the microblogging platform on X. And authorities say more than 70% of these threats came from one unverified anonymous account, which has since been suspended. So what it has done is a global disruption of flights, people trying to get connecting flights, reaching to different destinations. As you know, India is one of the biggest airline industry in the world. For example, a flight from Delhi to Chicago, middle of the week, was diverted to a remote Arctic airport in Canada. And then the passengers had to wait there for 18 hours. Then the Canadian Air Force had to bring them back to Chicago because the flight was delayed for nearly 2 days. They had to go through various procedures. And in the same way, a flight going to London was diverted to Frankfurt, and another flight, British Air Force jets were scrambled to intercept and to escort one of these Indian Airlines flights. So what it is doing is delays in flights, and also as soon as they land at any airport, they are being taken to a secluded area where the plane will be searched for explosives. All these security experts will be boarding the plane, check the baggages once again. So this is causing a lot of financial implications and delay for the passengers. They're missing their connecting flights, you know, stranded in the airports. And this is a real worry for the authorities.
Has anyone been arrested in connection with this?
See, what the Indian authorities are saying is that they've arrested a minor, about a 17-year-old boy, in connection with the threats. But even after this particular arrest, they are seeing these threats coming out. And what the authorities are saying is that some of those who are using these social media posts to send out these hoax threats, they are using VPNs, which means they are not able to be tracing these people and where these threats are coming from. But what they say is there is a pattern behind these messages, and they are confident they can trace them. But again, it is a week, it's a very long time, and this day and age, people might question how you cannot trace an email or even any social media account because the technology has grown. And that is why it is forcing the authorities to reassure the airline industry itself. For example, on Saturday, officials from India's Aviation Safety Body, Bureau of Civil Aviation Security, they met the CEOs of various airlines companies and to go over all the operating procedures in case of a bomb threat, and they were asked to follow the standard operating procedures, and then they are thinking about introducing more. But it is also costing a lot of money for the airline industry, and the government is very, very keen to find out where these messages are originating from.
And Barisan Etirajan, let's return briefly to our top story, the situation in Lebanon. The Israeli military says that in the coming hours it will attack branches of a bank there, accused of helping to finance Hezbollah. It's warned people in Beirut and other locations near the offices of Al-Qaed al-Hassan to leave immediately. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari is a spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces.
In a few minutes, we will be issuing an initial evacuation notice to Lebanese residents of Beirut and other locations to evacuate the sites used to finance Hezbollah's terrorist activities. I would like to stress here that anyone in the vicinity of sites used to finance Hezbollah's terrorist activities must leave immediately. We will be attacking a large number of targets in the coming hours and other targets later this evening.
This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Over 9 million homes are currently abandoned in Japan, according to a recent government survey. This is mostly due to declining birth rates and rural depopulation.
But there are also hundreds of thousands of empty homes in urban areas, even in some of the most sought-after neighbourhoods of the capital, Tokyo. So a growing number of foreigners who can't afford a house in their country of origin are now buying them up and refurbishing them. Our Tokyo correspondent Shaima Khalil has been to meet some of them.
It's a breezy morning here in Sanginjaya, the small but busy neighbourhood in Tokyo. It's about three stops from the famous Shibuya crossing. Imagine not being far from Westminster in London or Times Square in Manhattan, New York, minus the enormous price tag. I'm about to go and see one of Japan's 9 million empty homes, also known as IKEAs. They're scattered all over the country, including here in the capital, and they've been making waves on social media.
Welcome to my abandoned Japanese house.
Anton Werman is a male model turned renovator, now a famous TikToker, who's gone viral for chronicling his project and selling the idea of these cheap homes. I want to find out why is it that in a country where space is at a premium, millions of homes have been abandoned.
In this case, it was three siblings and their parents lived here. When the parents passed away, they had this house filled with stuff. Just getting rid of things costs a lot of money and also a lot of time.
How much did you pay for this?
About $100,000. What I essentially am paying for is the land. This is 9 years old, and houses in Japan, they depreciate, which means that after 30 years, they're basically not worth anything.
While they may seem like an opportunity, these empty homes are cheap for a reason. Japan's acid bubble burst in the early 1990s, and that meant decades of economic stagnation, which kept property prices low. There are millions of them because Japan's population has been aging and shrinking steadily for 15 years now. Some families have chosen to move to depopulated villages and refurbish abandoned old homes there.
Another reason why rural areas are turning into ghost towns is that young people just don't want to live there. And this is why you get the millions of IKEAs, or empty homes, so many that some villages and towns are giving them away for free.
My name's Sam King. I'm originally from the UK, and I've been in Japan about 7 years now.
I'm Nanami. I'm born and raised in Tokyo.
You guys have actually bought an IKEA. What's that been like?
If we had done a new build, that would have been a lot easier and straightforward. But it's such a beautiful house, and it's nice to preserve that and extend its life.
How much did you pay for the house?
It cost us £70,000, which is about $100,000.
For anyone who's thinking about buying an IKEA in Japan, what would you tell them?
Try and have someone who can advise you on the condition of the property, because some of these places sound really cheap, but then you get in there and you find there's problems with the structure or the water system is completely changing, like this place.
These 9 million empty homes tell the story of Japan's existentialist crisis. Japan is aging and desperate for more people. And yet, it doesn't encourage immigration, so there isn't much demand for property. For Japan's abandoned homes to come to life again, Japan itself needs to change.
That was Shaima Khalil reporting from Japan. With the BBC World Service and NewsHour, I'm Paul Henley. Voters in Moldova have now cast their votes in two contests to elect a new president, but also to decide in a referendum whether the constitution of this small Eastern European country should include the ambition of joining the EU. The current president, Maia Sandu, who strongly supports EU accession, is seeking a second term. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has been investigating claims of widespread Russian interference in this vote, and she's been at polling stations today. She joins us live from Chisinau, the capital. I believe some of the results, Sarah, are out already. Tell us more.
Yeah, they are. We are at Maia Sandu's election headquarters, and those results have been coming through for a couple of hours or so now. I have to say the mood here is not particularly cheerful, fairly subdued. People are waiting to see what it all adds up to. But for the moment, the vote on the EU referendum, is looking a lot less optimistic than people would have liked in this particular headquarters. At the moment, it's a 55% vote no for the EU referendum. And in terms of the presidential election, Maya Sandu is leading her nearest rival by several points. The gap does appear to be widening, but it's certainly not the emphatic first round victory that she and her team had been hoping for. I have to say, it's not all the votes are in yet, and her advisers are cautioning that so far these are the smaller places, the more conservative, the less advanced places, and the more eastern looking parts of the country. But in terms of the presidential election, for example, already 70% of the vote has been counted. And so I think that perhaps is a slightly optimistic reading for now from her advisers too.
And tell us about evidence that you've seen of foreign interference.
Yeah, so we've spent the last few days looking into this big claim that came from prosecutors and from police here that they had essentially busted a big network linked to Russia, they say, to channel funds into Moldova to essentially buy votes at this election. And you know, I've had the scheme explained to me. I've seen some of the evidence. And the suggestion is that this is money that's quite clearly coming from a fugitive businessman who's now in Moscow and being used to buy votes and influence on the ground. Now, the question is how many people who actually received money, and we understand that could be around 10% of the active electorate here, how many then went to the polls and voted as this man instructed them? That's a big question. Perhaps that has had some influence on the vote so far. But certainly I can tell you that in a polling station we went to today, a woman admitted very freely that she was told that she would be paid for voting. The reason she talked to us was because she was angry that she didn't get the cash. But certainly over the last couple of days, we've reported and investigated much more deeply the sort of broader claims of corruption here.
At Chisinau Airport, staff are on high alert. The sniffer dogs have been working extra hard too lately, searching for money that might be evidence of Russian meddling in Moldovan politics. Ami is a black retriever who gives every case on the baggage belt a good check, specially trained to detect large amounts of cash. When she does, I'm told, she'll freeze. She's done that a lot in recent months, helping to detect millions of dollars on passengers coming in from Moscow. The customs chief tells me at one point there were multiple flights every day, with everyone on board carrying big wads of cash. His team had disrupted a major operation to influence the vote here, ahead of a presidential election this weekend and a referendum that's supposed to enshrine Moldova's goal of joining the EU in the constitution.
Various conversations that we've intercepted, etc., it seems that the primary goal is to have the referendum fail.
Veronica Dragalin is the anti-corruption prosecutor, and she is staggered by a pyramid scheme that means around 10% of the electorate could have been paid to vote no to the EU.
I'm not aware of any other places where we've seen such a sort of brazen and kind of open attempt to corrupt a particular election. It is very worrying in that it's difficult to stop.
Я также призываю вас голосовать против преступных изменений в Конституции.
This is the fugitive businessman who's blamed. Ilan Shaw has been campaigning hard for a no vote in the referendum. In this video, he claims the EU will bring war to Moldova and other horrors. But he's the man who's accused of channeling cash to voters from Russia, where he now lives. It's going to places like Gagauzia, an autonomous part of Moldova that's long been sympathetic to Moscow.
Ну скажите, как он красив, видите?
The deputy governor is proud to show me how Shaw has been investing here. He calls him his political leader. It so happens he also admires Vladimir Putin, and the war on Ukraine right next door hasn't changed his views.
This is a slightly weird, desolate place. It's called Gagauzia Land. There's a giant rainbow-coloured archway at the entrance and a merry-go-round for kids. There's no one here today because it's really cold. But this whole project is funded by Ilan Shaw, the man who's under international sanctions, convicted by a Moldovan court, but in this region, a political hero figure.
Building a deserted wonderland with foreign cash isn't illegal. But paying for votes, trying to sway elections, definitely is. Ilya Uzun, though, the deputy governor, won't hear a bad word about Ilan Shor.
All they say about Ilan Shor, no one believes. He shows who he is by what he does. All this talk about the Kremlin and destabilizing Moldova, that's absolutely not true.
This woman tells me she's anti-Putin and pro-EU. But she's the only one I met. And several tell me the only thing Europe has is gay parades, as they put it. It's the exact same language I used to hear in Russia. Maya Sandu ended her re-election campaign among close supporters, cheered and clapped all the way through the streets with shouts of president. Since her election 4 years ago, she has turned Moldova away from Moscow definitively. For her, the invasion of Ukraine was a crunch point. President Sandu is now calling for a firm yes vote to joining the EU, for Chisinau to make its choice. But it looks like Russia is refusing to accept that.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reporting. Well, as the results continue to come in, let's hear from Nicu Popescu, who is a fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He was the former Moldovan foreign minister and the lead coordinator of Moldova's EU accession process. Mr. Popescu, welcome back to the programme. What do you make of these preliminary results that show a lead for the no vote in the referendum on EU membership first?
Well, when it comes to the referendum, for now it shows a lead for the no vote. Usually smaller villages and towns are counted. And usually as the counting advances and goes to bigger cities, more urbanized, slightly more prosperous communities with the vote results usually tend to show a stronger showing to for the EU vote. So I think there's a reasonable chance the referendum will pass. Then, of course, there's the diaspora vote. So there's a reasonable chance the referendum will pass, but it would be a narrow victory.
Okay, on the presidential vote, Maia Sandu is in the lead, but only marginally. If it goes to a second round, which looks likely in 2 weeks' time, that's not good news for her, is it? The pro-EU president.
Yes, for now, the preliminary results could look better. Again, we have the same tendency. People are expected now for the votes from the capital city of Chisinau to be counted, the diaspora. And then we'll see. The tendency will be to slightly increase the share of votes given to the president, Maia Sandu, and then we'll see what happens in the second round.
Even if the vote does pick up in your favour as counting continues, this is not good news, is it, what has been revealed so far? The country is fundamentally split. It's certainly not what you've been hoping for.
It's certainly a result that looks difficult at the moment. It's also a reflection of the fact that Moldova has had a pretty rough several years. Of course, you had the COVID before the war in Ukraine, and then the economic shock of the war in Ukraine has been much greater in Moldova than in pretty much any other European country. And that, of course, has left a pretty significant imprint on the population's view of politicians. So, again, let's see what the final results are, but no one, you know, everyone realized Moldova has been in a pretty difficult place economically, inflation-wise, energy costs-wise. We see this in quite a lot of European countries, but of course the shock for Moldova has been even greater than in Poland or Slovakia or France or Germany.
Sarah Rainsford reports, much of it concentrated on alleged Russian meddling in these votes. Is it a red herring to suggest that that might have changed the result when we're talking about such a fundamental difference of opinion among Moldovan people?
It's very likely, of course, that this had an impact. It had an impact that came on top of the natural dissatisfaction with people of where the economy is. Let's see when we'll have the final results. We will be able to look into the details on what happened, where turnout. But presumably these massive amounts of Russian vote buying schemes, disinformation had an impact on significant parts of the Moldovan population.
And how interested do you think Russia is in the result of this vote?
It's very interested for several reasons. Of course, Moldova has been a target of Russian destabilization attempts since over 30 years. That's not a surprise. But of course, in the context of the war in Ukraine, Russia's interest in derailing Moldova's EU path, strong partnership with the EU, with Ukraine, also acquires a much wider geopolitical interest for Russia than just if you look at Russian objectives in Moldova.
And of course,
Russia would...
Sorry, I'm going to have to end it there, but many thanks for coming on the programme. Nicu Popescu, who is a fellow with the Council, the European Council on Foreign Relations, also former Moldovan Foreign Minister. You're with the BBC World Service. Live from London, this is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. To the US now, and across the country, there are serious doubts about whether all voters will accept the results of next month's presidential elections. Donald Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance, continue to cast doubt on the result of 4 years ago. And those doubts about voting have, in extreme cases, already inspired threats and harassment against election volunteers. Mike Wendling has been to speak to a few of them in rural Wisconsin.
I have been appointed to the office of election inspector.
American democracy at its most grassroots. A group of election workers gets sworn in Black River Falls, town of a few thousand souls in rural western Wisconsin. They're mostly elderly, mostly female, and they'll greet the people that will come next month to cast their votes here in Jackson County. But behind this wholesome display of civic duty, there are some dark feelings brewing.
I worry that I didn't prepare them to be safe.
Melissa Como is clerk of a small Wisconsin town, and she also travels around the state delivering training like this to volunteers.
I've been concerned for several years now about just people trying to tamper with the vote, even on the local level. When people perceive the stakes as being very high, that then they're willing to do extreme actions in order to win.
The main thing driving what Melissa Como is talking about is the swirl of conspiracy theories and rumors being spread by Donald Trump and his allies. They insist that Trump won the 2020 election and that Democrats cheated. The claims vary. They include things like illegal voting by immigrants, dodgy voting machines, ballot box stuffing, and more. But the key thing that unites them all is they've been examined by courts, by journalists, by government investigators, and by officials from both major political parties, and have all been found almost entirely without merit. In 2020, threats were directed against election workers in big cities in swing states, Atlanta, Georgia, Detroit, Michigan, Phoenix, Arizona. But now election volunteers all over the country find themselves a target, even here in rural Wisconsin.
I had a man come in asking all kinds of questions about our voting machine, taking pictures of the voting machine.
Chris Burlingame is a longtime elections worker in Alma Center, a tiny village of about 500 people. Part of her duties is holding a public test of voting machines. Usually, she says, nobody shows up. But in early August, one man did.
He was middle-aged. He had just moved into the area, and he was belligerent. I felt as though we were being accused of rigging it. Because I asked, I says, why are you taking a picture of this? And he said, because these are the machines that changed everybody's votes. But there's no way that it can change votes.
Was it scary at all? Or
it was a little bit. Yeah, I wasn't afraid, but it did make me stop and think, what is the election going to be like?
Eventually, the man left of his own accord. The police did not have to be called, but incidents like this are becoming more common. The Brennan Center, a left-leaning but nonpartisan think tank, conducted a survey of election workers earlier this year and found that nearly two-fifths had experienced threats, harassment, or abuse. The Brennan Center's Elizabeth Howard says the think tank started to poll workers about threats following the 2020 election.
The false information about our elections and our election officials spur on the threats that election officials are facing. This is not a partisan issue. Election officials on both sides of the aisle have been threatened.
Just ask Bill Gates. No relation to the Microsoft founder, this Bill Gates is the Republican supervisor of Maricopa County in Arizona, which includes Phoenix.
I mean, even to this day, people are still questioning the 2020 election. You know, it's really kind of taken over our lives.
Mr. Gates suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder because of the threats he received in 2020. And for a variety of reasons, he is not seeking re-election as county supervisor this year. Back in western Wisconsin, the local Republican county chairman Bill Laurent says he's not worried about any violence at the polls around here. But he also told me, though he didn't want to be recorded, that he was worried that Democrats would somehow steal the election, echoing those false conspiracy theories.
Who's nervous about observers in the polling place?
After the training session, I asked election worker Chris Burlingame if she was personally worried about Election Day threats.
I don't think anything's going to happen, but I'm not going to have a blind eye. There's just some people that I just don't feel I can trust, and that scares me.
That report was from Mike Wendling in small town Wisconsin in the U.S. And before we wrap up this edition of NewsHour, we'll return to our top story and the situation in the Middle East, because there's an urgent focus on Gaza and how to restore order and bring back some degree of welfare for its 2 million citizens if and when the war ends. The need in Gaza can hardly be exaggerated, so much there having been destroyed. We asked Mahmoud Rostom, who's a freelance journalist from Khan Yunis in the south, to go back to the street where he, his parents and his 8 siblings once lived. Here's his story.
Before the Israelis started their operating here in Khan Yunis, there was a life. Everything was amazing. Everything is okay, the mosques, the streets, the schools, and my house, a simple house, an amazing family. When I entered my home, I felt warm. I felt that there is too much love inside this house. I used to go to university. The street was full of joy. You can smell the life inside the shops and street. I have 8 siblings. My family owns a bakery. But this bakery was partially destroyed also by the Israeli army when they started their operation here in Khan Yunis. The Israeli army completely bulldozed most of the streets in the city of Khan Yunis. In front of me, and starting from the mosque that turned into rubble, then passing through a primary school for children, and then a secondary school for girls, which turned into a pile of stones. I can see some of houses, some of our neighbors' houses standing, but all of it is partial damage. It need to be and need to rebuild again because it's unlivable. The neighbors here went back to their homes, but they are afraid because anytime this place may collapse in their heads.
That was Mahmoud Rostom, who's from southern Gaza. A quick update on a story that we were covering earlier in the program. Large parts of Cuba having been without power today. The imminent arrival on Cuban shores of Hurricane Oscar threatens to complicate things more. In the past few minutes, a statement from the Cuban Energy and Mines Ministry says that the electrical grid has collapsed on the island again amid efforts to restore it. That was NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye for now.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.